to be on crutches for quite a while. Yes, well, Abigail has already said she's moving back home to help you. Oh, said Madeline. Oh. She fingered the pink petals of the flowers. Well, I'll talk to her about it. I'll be perfectly fine. She doesn't need to look after me. No, but I think she wants to move back home, said Nathan. She's looking for an excuse. Madeline and Ed looked at each other. Ed shrugged. I always thought the novelty would wear off, said Nathan. She missed her mum. We're not her real life. Right. So I should get going, said Ed. Could you stay a moment, mate? Said Nathan. The big, positive thinking smile had gone, and now he looked like the man in the wrong at a car accident. I wouldn't mind talking to the two of you for a bit. About what happened last night. Ed grimaced, but he pulled over a nearby chair and placed it next to his, gesturing for Nathan to sit. Oh, thanks. Thanks, mate. Nathan looked pathetically grateful as he sat down. There was a long pause. Ed cleared his throat. Bonnie's father was violent, said Nathan without preamble. Very violent. I don't think I even know half the stuff he did. Not to Bonnie, to her mum. But Bonnie and her little sister saw it all. They had a very tough childhood. I'm not sure I should, began Ed. I never met her dad, continued Nathan. He died of a heart attack before I met Bonnie. Anyway, Bonnie is, well, one psychiatrist diagnosed post-traumatic stress. She's fine most of the time, but she has very bad nightmares and just, some difficulties sometimes. He looked blankly past Madeline to the wall behind her head. His eyes were blank as he considered all the secrets of what Madeline now realized was his complicated marriage. You don't have to tell us any of this, said Madeline. She's a good person, Maddie, said Nathan desperately. He wasn't looking at Ed. His eyes were fixed on Madeline. He was calling on their history. He was calling on past memories and past love. Even though he'd walked out on her, he was asking her to forget all that and remember the days when they were obsessed with each other, when they woke up smiling goofily at each other. It was crazy, but she knew that's what he was asking. He was asking 20-year-old Madeline for a favor. She's a wonderful mother, said Nathan. The best mother. And I can promise you she never, ever meant for Perry to fall. I think it was just that when she saw him hit Celeste like that... Something snapped, said Madeline. She saw Perry's hand swinging back in its graceful, practiced arc. She heard Bonnie's guttural voice. It occurred to her that there were so many levels of evil in the world. Small evils like her own malicious words. Like not inviting a child to a party. Bigger evils like walking out on your wife and newborn baby or sleeping with your child's nanny. And then there was a sort of evil of which Madeline had no experience. Cruelty in hotel rooms and violence in suburban homes. And little girls being sold like merchandise, shattering innocent hearts. I know you don't owe me anything, said Nathan, because obviously what I did to you when Abigail was a baby was completely unforgivable and... Nathan, interrupted Madeline. It was crazy, and it made no sense because she did not forgive him. And she chose to never forgive him, and he would drive her to distraction for the rest of her life. And one day he'd walk Abigail down the aisle, and Madeline would be grinding her teeth the whole way. But he was still family. He still belonged on her piece of cardboard, showing her family tree. How could she possibly explain to Ed that she didn't particularly like Bonnie or understand her, but that it turned out she was prepared to lie for her in the same way that she would automatically lie for Ed, her children, her sister? It turned out, as strange and improbable as it seemed, that Bonnie was family too. We're not going to say anything to the police, said Madeline. We didn't see what happened. We didn't see a thing. Ed stood with a sudden backward scrape of his chair and left the room without looking back. Detective Sergeant Adrian Quinlan. Someone is not telling the truth about what happened on that balcony. Chapter 79. The policeman looked like a nice young soccer dad, but there was something cool and knowing about his tired green eyes. He was sitting next to Jane's hospital bed with a pen poised over his yellow notepad. Let me get this straight. You were standing on the balcony, but you were looking back inside.
Yes, said Jane, because of all the noise. People were throwing things.
And then you heard Celeste White scream.
I think so, said Jane. It's all so confusing. Everything is muddled.
Those champagne cocktails. Yes, sighed the policeman. Those champagne cocktails. I've heard a lot about them.
Everyone was very drunk, said Jane.
Where were you standing in relation to Perry White?
I think sort of off to one side.
The last nurse had said that someone would be taking her for an X-ray soon. Her parents were on their way with Ziggy. She looked at the door of her room and wished for someone, anyone, to come and save her from this conversation.
And what was your relationship with Perry? Were you friends?
Jane thought of the moment when he took off his wig and became Saxon Banks. She never got to tell him that he had a son called Ziggy who liked pumpkin. She never got an apology. Was that what she'd come to Pirui for? Because she wanted his remorse? She actually thought she'd get his remorse? She closed her eyes. We only met for the first time last night. I'd only just been introduced to him.
I think you're lying, said the policeman.
He put down his notepad. Jane flinched at his sudden change of tone. His voice had the implacability, the weight and violence of a swinging hammer.
Are you lying?
Chapter 80. There's someone here who wants to see you, said Celeste's mother. Celeste looked up from the couch where she was sitting with the boys on either side of her watching cartoons. She didn't want to move from her position. The boys were comforting, warm, heavy weights against her body. She didn't know what the children were thinking. They'd cried when she told them about their father, but she wondered if they were crying because Perry had promised to take them fishing at the rock pool this morning, and now that wasn't happening.
She suspected that right now their little minds were as blank and stunned as hers, and that the bright flickering colours of the cartoon characters were the only thing that felt real. "It's not another journalist, is it?" she said.
"Her name is Bonnie," said her mother. "She says she's one of the school mums and she'd just like to talk to you for a few minutes. She says it's important."
"She brought this."
Her mother lifted a casserole dish. "She says it's a vegetarian lasagna."
Her mother lifted an eyebrow to indicate her opinion of a vegetarian lasagna. Celeste stood, gently lifting the boys and letting them fall on their sides on the couch. They made little murmurs of protest, but didn't move their eyes from the television. Bonnie was waiting for her in the living room, standing very still, looking out to the ocean with her long blonde plait falling down the centre of her yoga straight back. Celeste stood in the doorway and watched her for a moment. This was the woman responsible for her husband's death. Bonnie turned slowly and smiled sadly. "Celeste." You couldn't imagine this placid, luminous-skinned woman screaming, "We see! We fucking see!" You couldn't imagine her swearing. "Thank you for the lasagna," said Celeste, meaning it. She knew that soon her house would be filled with Perry's grieving family members.
"Well, that's the least..." Bonnie's smile faded. "The word sorry is hardly adequate for my actions, but I needed to come here to say it."
"It was an accident," said Celeste faintly. "You didn't mean for him to fall."
"Your little boys," said Bonnie, "how are they?"
"I don't think they really understand anything yet," said Celeste.
"No," said Bonnie. "They wouldn't."
She breathed out a long, slow, deliberate breath through her mouth, as if she were demonstrating yogic breathing.
"I'm going to the police now," said Bonnie. "I'm going to make a statement and tell them exactly how it happened. You don't need to lie for me."
"I already told them last night I didn't see..."
Bonnie held up her hand. "They'll be back again for a proper witness statement. This time, just tell them the truth."
She took another long, slow breath.
"I was going to lie. I've had a lot of practice, you see. I'm a good liar. When I was growing up, I lied all the time. To the police, to social workers. I had to keep big secrets. I even let a journalist interview me this morning, and I was fine. But then, I don't know, I went to pick up my little girl from my mother's place. And when I walked in the front door, I remembered the last time I saw my father hit my mother. I was 20. A grown-up. I'd gone home for a visit, and it started. Mum did something. I don't remember what. She didn't put enough tomato sauce on his plate. She laughed the wrong way." Bonnie looked directly at Celeste. "You know."
"I know," said Celeste hoarsely. She put her hand on the couch where Perry had once held her head. "You know what I did? I ran to my old bedroom and I hid under the bed." Bonnie gave a little bitter laugh of disbelief. "Because that's what my sister and I always did. I didn't even think. I just ran. And I lay there on my stomach, my heart pounding, looking at that old green shag carpet, waiting for it to be over. And then all of a sudden I thought, my God, what am I doing? I'm a grown woman hiding under the bed. So I got out and I called the police. Bonnie pulled her plait over her shoulder and readjusted the elastic at the end. I don't hide under the bed anymore. I don't keep secrets. And I don't want people to keep secrets for me. She smiled and pushed her plait back over her shoulder. Anyway, the truth is bound to come out. Madeline and Renata will be able to lie to the police, but definitely not Ed. And not Jane. And probably not even my poor, hopeless husband. Nathan will probably be the worst of the lot. I would have lied for you, said Celeste. I can lie. I know you can. Bonnie's eyes were bright. I think you're probably very good at it, too. She stepped forward and put her hand on Celeste's arm. But you can stop now. Chapter 81. Bonnie is telling the truth. It was a text message from Celeste. Madeline fumbled the phone as she dialed Ed's number. It suddenly seemed as though the future of her marriage depended on her reaching him before he went in for his interview. The phone rang and rang. It was too late. What is it? His voice was curt. Relief flooded her. Where are you? I've just parked the car. I'm about to go into the police station. Bonnie is confessing, said Madeline. You don't need to lie for her. There was silence. Ed, she said, did you hear me? You can tell them exactly what you saw. You can tell them the truth. It sounded like he was crying. He never cried. You shouldn't have asked that of me, he said roughly. That was too much to ask of me. That was for him. You were asking me to do that for your ex-bloody husband. I know, said Madeline. She was crying now too. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I was going to do it. No, you weren't, my darling, she thought as she brushed away her tears with the back of her hand. No, you weren't. Dear Ziggy, I don't know if you remember this, but last year at kindergarten orientation day, I was not very nice to you. I believed that you had hurt my daughter, and I now know this was not true. I hope you will forgive me, and I hope that your mum will forgive me too. I behaved very badly to you both, and I am sorry. Amabella is having a going-away party before we move to London, and we would be honoured if you would attend as our very special guest. The theme is Star Wars. Amabella said to bring your lightsaber. Yours sincerely, Renata Klein. Amabella's mum. Chapter 82. 4 weeks after the trivia night. Has she tried to speak to you? Said Jane to Tom. That journalist who is interviewing everyone? It was mid-morning on a beautiful winter day. They stood together on the boardwalk outside Blue Blues. A woman sat at a table near the window, frowning as she transcribed notes onto her laptop from a dictaphone attached to her ear by a single earplug. Sarah, said Tom. Yeah. I just give her free muffins and tell her I've got nothing to say. I'm hoping she'll mention the muffins in her story. She's been interviewing people since the morning after the trivia night, said Jane. Ed thinks she's trying to get a book deal. Apparently, even Bonnie spoke to her before she was charged. She must have reams of stuff. Tom waved to the journalist, and she waved back, lifting her coffee in a salute. Let's go, said Tom. They were taking some sandwiches around to the headland for an early lunch. Jane's sling for her broken collarbone had come off yesterday. The doctor had told her she could start doing some gentle exercise. Are you sure Maggie can handle the cafe? Asked Jane, referring to Tom's only part-time employee. Sure. Her coffee is better than mine, said Tom. No, it's not, said Jane loyally. They walked up the stairs where Jane used to meet Celeste for their walks after school drop-off. She thought of Celeste hurrying to meet her, flustered and worried because she was late again, oblivious to a middle-aged jogger who had nearly run into a tree trying to get a second look at her. She had barely seen Celeste since the funeral. The worst part of the funeral had been those little boys, with their blonde hair slicked to the side, their good white dress shirts and little black pants, their serious faces. There was a letter that Max had written to his father and placed on top of the coffin. Daddy, in uneven scrawling letters, with a picture of two stick figures. The school had tried to support the parents of the kindergarten class as they decided whether or not to send their children to the funeral. An email had gone out with helpful links to articles written by psychologists. Should I let my child attend a funeral? The parents who didn't let their children go were hopeful that those kids who did attend would have nightmares and be just a little bit scarred for life, at least enough to affect their university entrance results. The parents who did let their children go were hopeful their kids would have learned valuable lessons about the circle of life and supporting friends in their hour of need, and would probably be more resilient, which would stand them well in their teenage years, making them less likely to commit suicide or become drug addicts. Jane had let Ziggy go because he wanted to go, and also because it was his father's funeral, even though he didn't know it, and there would be no second chance to let him attend his father's funeral. Would she tell him one day? Do you remember when you were little, you went to your first funeral? But he would try to attach some sort of meaning to it. He would look for something that Jane finally understood wasn't there. For the last 5 years, she'd been searching fruitlessly for meaning in a drunken, nasty act of infidelity. And there was no meaning. The church had been packed with Perry's grief-stricken family. Perry's sister, Ziggy's aunt, Jane had told herself as she sat in the back of the church with the other school parents who didn't really know Perry, had put together a little movie to commemorate Perry's life. It was so professionally done, it felt like a real movie, and it had the effect of making Perry's life seem more vibrant, rich, and substantial than the lives currently being lived by the congregation. There were crisp, clear photos of him as a fair-haired, chubby baby, a plump little boy, a suddenly handsome teenager, a gorgeous groom kissing his gorgeous wife, a proud new father of twins with a baby in each arm. There were video clips of him rap dancing with the kids, blowing out candles, skiing with the boys between his legs. The soundtrack was beautiful and perfectly synchronized for maximum emotional impact, so that by the end, even school parents who barely knew Perry were sobbing violently, and one man accidentally clapped. Ever since the funeral, Jane kept remembering that movie. It seemed irrefutable evidence that Perry was a good man, a good husband and father. Her memories of him in the hotel room and on the balcony, the casual violence with which he'd treated Celeste, felt flimsy and unlikely. The man with two little boys on his knees, laughing in slow motion at someone off camera, could not possibly have done those things. Forcing herself to remember what she knew to be true about Perry seemed pointless and pedantic, almost maliciously so. It was better manners to remember that nice movie. Jane hadn't seen Celeste cry at the funeral. Her eyes were puffy and bloodshot, but Jane hadn't seen her cry. She looked like she was clenching her teeth, like she was waiting something out, for some awful pain to pass. The only time it looked like she might have broken down into tears was when Jane had seen her outside the church, comforting a tall, good-looking man who could barely walk. He seemed to be so weighed down by his grief. Jane thought she heard Celeste say, "Oh, Saxon," as she took his arm, but perhaps that was her mind playing tricks on her. "Are you going to speak to her?" asked Tom, as they reached the top of the stairs. "To Celeste," said Jane. They hadn't spoken, or at least not properly. Celeste's mother was staying with her, helping her with the boys, and Jane knew that Perry's family were also taking up a lot of her time. Jane felt as though she and Celeste would never talk about Perry. On one hand, there was far too much to say, and on the other, there was nothing. Madeline said that Celeste was moving to an apartment in McMahon's Point. The big, beautiful house was going on the market. "Not Celeste," Tom gave her an odd look. "To that journalist." "Oh," said Jane. "Good God, no. No, I haven't. I won't. Ed said I should say no thank you when she calls, in a firm, polite voice, and hang up fast, the same way you do with a telemarketer. He said people get this strange idea that they have to talk to journalists, and of course you don't. They're not like the police." She had no desire to talk to the journalist. Too many secrets. Just thinking about the policeman interviewing her in the hospital made her feel breathless. Thank God Bonnie had decided to confess. "Are you feeling okay?" Tom stopped and put his hand on her arm. "I'm not walking too fast?" She smiled up at him. "I'm fine. Just out of condition." "We'll get you back to your normal athletic self." She flicked his chest with her fingertip. "Shut up." He smiled. She couldn't see his eyes because he was wearing sunglasses. What were they now? Very dear friends who were more like siblings? Flirty friends who knew they would never take it any further? She honestly couldn't tell. Their attraction at the trivia night had been like a tiny, perfect blossom that needed tender nurturing, or at least a drunken first kiss up against a wall in the school car park. But then everything that happened, happened. Their little seedling got stomped on by a big black boot. Death and blood and broken bones and police and a story she hadn't yet told him about Ziggy's father. They couldn't seem to get back on track now. Their rhythm was all off. Last week, they'd been out together on a date-like night to the movies and dinner. It had been perfectly nice, perfectly comfortable. They were already such good friends from all the hours they'd talked when she'd worked in Blue Blues. but nothing had happened. They hadn't even gotten close. It appeared that Tom and Jane were destined for friendship. It was mildly disappointing, but not devastating. Friends could last a lifetime. The statistics were better than for relationships. This morning she'd gotten a text from her friend's cousin asking if she wanted to get together for that drink. She texted back, "Yes, please." They walked to the park bench with the plaque dedicating it to Victor Berg, who loved to walk around this headland. "Those we love don't go away. They sit beside us every day." It always made Jane think of Poppy, who was born in the same year as Victor. "How's Ziggy?" asked Tom as they sat down and went to open their sandwiches. "He's good," said Jane. She looked out at the expanse of blue. "Great." Ziggy had made friends with a new boy at school who had just moved back to Australia after living in Singapore for 2 years. Ziggy and Lucas were suddenly inseparable. Lucas's parents, a couple in their 40s, had invited Jane and Ziggy over for dinner. There were plans to set Jane up with Lucas's uncle. Tom suddenly put his hand on Jane's arm. "Oh my God!" "What?" said Jane. He was looking out to sea as if he'd seen something. "I think I'm getting a message," he said. He put a finger to his temple. "Yes. Yes, I am. It's from Victor."
"Victor?"
"Victor Berg, who loved to walk around this headland," said Tom impatiently. He jabbed a finger at the plaque. "Vic, mate, what is it?"
"God, you're a dork," said Jane affectionately.
Tom looked at Jane. "Vic says, if I don't hurry up and kiss this girl, I'm a bloody fool."
"Oh," said Jane. She felt a rush of goosebumps. Her stomach lurched with elation, as if she'd won a prize. She'd been trying to comfort herself with little lies. My God, of course she'd been disappointed that nothing was happening. She'd been so, so disappointed. "Really? Is that what he's..." But he was already kissing her, one hand on the side of her face, the other removing the sandwich from her lap and putting it on the seat next to him. And it turned out that little seedling hadn't been crushed, after all, and that first kisses didn't necessarily require darkness and alcohol. They could happen in the open air, with the sun warm on your face, and everything around you honest and real and true. And thank God she hadn't been chewing gum, because she would have had to have swallowed it, quick smart, and she might have missed the fact that Tom tasted exactly the way she always suspected he'd taste, of cinnamon sugar and coffee and the sea. "I was worried we were destined for friendship," she said when they came up for air. Tom brushed a lock of her hair off her forehead and tucked it behind her ear. "Are you kidding? Besides, I've got enough friends."
Chapter 83. Samantha. "So, we're done then? You've got everything you need? Quite a saga, eh? We're all back to normal now, except all us parents are being extremely nice to one another. It's kind of hilarious."
Gabrielle, "They've cancelled the spring ball. We're sticking to cake stalls now. Just what I need. I put on 5 kilos from the stress of all this."
Thea, "Renata is moving to London. The marriage is kaput. I would have tried harder myself, but that's just me. I can't help myself. I just have to put my children first."
Harper,
Naturally, we'll be visiting Renata in London next year. Once she's settled, of course. She says it might take a while. Yes, I am giving Graham a second chance. One trashy little nanny isn't going to destroy my marriage. Well, don't worry. He's paying. Not just with his cracked ribs. We're all off to see the Lion King tonight. Stew. The biggest mystery is this. Why didn't that French bird ever make a move on me? Jonathan. She actually did make a move on me, but that's off the record. Miss Barnes. I have no idea what happened to the petition. No one spoke of it again after the trivia night. We're all looking forward to a new term and a fresh start. I thought we might do a special unit on conflict resolution. It seems appropriate. Jackie. Hopefully the kids can be left alone now to learn to read and write. Mrs. Lipman. I think perhaps we've all learned to be a little kinder to one another. And to document everything. Everything. Carol. So, apparently, Madeline's book club didn't actually have anything to do with erotic fiction at all. It was all a joke. Such prudes they turned out to be. But funnily enough, just yesterday, a friend from church mentioned she belonged to a Christian erotic fiction club. I'm already three chapters into our first book, and I won't lie, it's quite fun, and really rather, well, what's the word? Spicy? Detective Sergeant Adrian Quinlan. I thought it was the wife, to be honest. All my instincts were telling me it was the wife. I would have put money on it. Goes to show you can't always trust your instincts. So there you go. That's it. You must have all you need by now, right? You're turning that off. Because I was wondering, oh, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I wondered if you fancied a drip. Chapter 84. A year after the trivia night. Celeste sat behind a long table with a white tablecloth, waiting for her name to be called. Her heart thumped. Her mouth was dry. She picked up the glass of water in front of her and watched her hand tremble. She quickly put it back down. She wasn't sure if she could get it safely to her mouth without spilling it. She'd spoken in court a few times recently, but this was different. She didn't want to cry, although Susie had told her it was fine and understandable and even likely. You'll be speaking about some very personal, very painful experiences, said Susie. It's a big thing I'm asking of you. Celeste looked out at the small audience of men and women in suits and ties. Their faces were blank, professional. Some of them looked a little bored. I always pick someone in the audience, Perry had told her once when they were talking about public speaking. A friendly-looking face, somewhere right in the middle of the crowd. And when I get up, I speak to him or her. As if it's just the two of us. She remembered that she'd been surprised to hear that Perry needed any techniques at all. He always appeared so scrupulously confident and relaxed when he spoke in public, like a charismatic Hollywood star on a talk show. But that was Perry. Looking back, it seemed that he'd actually lived his life in a state of perpetual low-level fear. Fear of humiliation, fear of losing her, fear of not being loved. For a moment, she wished he were here to see her speak. She couldn't help thinking that he'd be proud of her, in spite of the subject matter. The real Perry would be proud of her. Was that delusional? Probably, yes. Delusional thinking was her specialty these days. Or perhaps it had always been her specialty. The hardest thing over the past year had been second-guessing and mistrusting her every passing thought and emotion. Every time she cried over Perry's death, it was a betrayal of Jane. It was foolish and misguided and wrong to grieve for a man who had done what he'd done. It was wrong to cry over the tears of her sons when there was another little boy who didn't even know that Perry was his father. The right emotions were hatred and fury and regret. That was how she should be feeling, and she was happy when she felt all those things, which she often did because they were appropriate, rational feelings. But then she'd find herself missing him and looking forward to when he returned home from his trip. And she'd feel idiotic all over again and remind herself that Perry had cheated on her, probably on multiple occasions. In her dreams, she screamed at him, "How dare you! How dare you!" She hit him over and over. She woke with tears still wet on her face. "I still love him," she told Susie, as if she were confessing something disgusting. "You're allowed to still love him?"
"I'm going crazy," she told her.
"You're working through it," said Susie. And she listened patiently as Celeste talked through every misdemeanor for which Perry had punished her, in what must have been excruciating detail. "I know I should have gotten the boys to tidy up the Lego that day, but I was tired. I shouldn't have said what I said. I shouldn't have done what I did." For some reason, she needed to pick endlessly over every detail of events over the last 5 years and try to get it straight in her mind. "That wasn't fair, was it?" she kept saying to Susie, as if Susie were the referee, as if Perry were there listening to this independent arbiter. "Do you think it was fair?" Susie would say, just like a good therapist should. "Do you think you deserved that?" Celeste watched the man sitting to her right pick up his glass of water. His hand trembled even worse than hers, but he persevered on bringing it to his mouth, even as the ice cubes clinked and water slopped over his hand. He was a tall, pleasant-looking, thin-faced man in his mid-30s, wearing a tie under an ill-fitting red sweater. He must be another counsellor, like Susie, but one who suffered a pathological fear of public speaking. Celeste wanted to put her hand on his arm to comfort him, but she didn't want to embarrass him when he, after all, was the professional here. She looked down and saw where his black trousers had ridden up. He was wearing light brown ankle socks with his well-polished black business shoes. It was the sort of sartorial mishap that would give Madeline a fit. Celeste had let Madeline help choose her a new white silk shirt to wear today, together with a pencil skirt and black court shoes. "No toes," Madeline had said when Celeste had modelled the outfit with her choice of sandals. "Toes are not right for this event." Celeste had acquiesced. She'd been letting Madeline do a lot of things for her over the past year. "I should have known," Madeline had kept saying. "I should have known what you were going through." No matter how many times Celeste assured her that there was no possible way that she could have known, that Celeste would never have permitted her to know, Madeline had continued to battle genuine guilt. All Celeste could do was let her be there for her now. Celeste looked for her friendly face in the audience and settled on a woman in her 50s, with a bright, bird-like face, who was nodding along encouragingly as Susie did her introduction. She reminded Celeste a little of the boys' new Year One teacher at their new school just around the corner from the flat. Celeste had made an appointment to see her before they started. They idolized their father, and since his death, they've been having some behavioral issues, Celeste had told her at her first meeting. Of course they have, said Mrs. Hooper. She looked like nothing would surprise her. Let's have a weekly meeting so we can stay on top of this. Celeste had managed not to throw her arms around her and cry into her nice floral blouse. The twins had not coped well over the past year. They were so used to Perry being gone for long periods that it took a long time for them to understand that he wasn't ever coming home. They reacted like their father reacted when things went wrong. Angrily. Violently. Every day they tried to kill each other, and every night they ended up in the same bed, their heads on the same pillow. Seeing their grief felt like a punishment to Celeste. But a punishment for what? For staying with their father? For wanting him to die? Bonnie did not have to do jail time. She was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter by an unlawful and dangerous act and sentenced to 200 hours of community service. In handing down his sentence, the judge noted that the defendant's moral culpability was at the lower end of the scale for this type of offence. He took into account the fact that Bonnie did not have a criminal record, was clearly remorseful, and that, although it was possibly foreseeable that the victim would fall, this was not her intent. He also took into account the testimony of expert witnesses who proved that the balcony railing was beneath the minimum height requirements of the current building code, that the bar stools were not appropriate for use on the balcony, and that other contributing factors included the weather, the consequent slipperiness of the railing, and the intoxication of both the defendant and the victim. According to Madeline, Bonnie had performed her community service with great pleasure, Abigail by her side, the whole time. There were letters going back and forth from insurance companies and lawyers, but it felt like something between all of them. Celeste had made it clear she wanted no money from the school, and that she would be donating back any payouts she received to cover higher insurance premiums as a result of the accident. The house and the other properties had been sold, and Celeste had moved the boys into the little apartment in McMahon's Point and had gone back to work 3 days a week at a family law firm. She enjoyed the fact that she didn't think about anything else for hours at a time. Her boys were trust fund kids, but their trust funds weren't going to define them, and she was determined that Max and Josh would one day be asking, "Do you want fries with that?" She'd also set up a trust fund of equal value for Ziggy. "You don't need to do that," Jane had said when she told her over lunch at a cafe near Celeste's apartment. She'd looked appalled, almost nauseous. "We don't want his money. Your money, I mean." "It's Ziggy's money." If Perry knew Ziggy was his son, he would have wanted him to be treated exactly the same as Max and Josh, Celeste had told her. Perry was... But then she'd found herself unable to speak. Because how could she say to Jane that Perry was generous to a fault and scrupulously fair? Her husband had always been so fair, except for those times when he was monstrously unfair. But Jane had reached across the cafe table and taken her hand and said, "I know he was.
almost as if she did understand everything that Perry was and wasn't. Susie stood at the lectern. She looked nice today. She'd cut back on the eye makeup, thank goodness. Domestic violence victims often don't look at all like you'd expect them to look, said Susie. And their stories don't always sound as black and white as you'd expect them to sound. Celeste searched for her friendly face in the audience of emergency department doctors, triage nurses, GPs, and counsellors. Which is why I've asked these two lovely people here today. They've very generously given up their time to share their experiences with you. Susie lifted her hand to encompass Celeste and the man sitting next to her. He had placed one hand on his own thigh to try to stop his leg jiggling up and down with nerves. My God, thought Celeste. She blinked back a sudden rush of hot tears. He's not a counsellor. He's someone like me. It happened to him. She turned to look at him, and he smiled back at her, his eyes darting about like tiny fish. Celeste, said Susie. Celeste stood. She glanced back at the man in the sweater, and then over to Susie, who smiled encouragingly, and Celeste walked the few steps to stand behind the wooden lectern. She searched the audience for that nice-looking woman. Yes, there she was, smiling, nodding a little. Celeste took a breath. She'd agreed to come here today as a favour for Susie, and because, sure, she wanted to do her bit to make sure health professionals knew when to ask more questions, when not to let things go. She'd been planning to give them the facts, but not to spill her soul. She would keep her dignity. She would keep a little piece of herself safe. But now she was suddenly filled with a passionate desire to share everything. To say the bare, ugly truth. To hold nothing back. Fuck dignity. She wanted to give that terrified man in the uncool sweater the confidence to share his own bare, ugly truth. She wanted to let him know that at least one person here today understood all the mistakes he'd made along the way. The times he'd hit back. The times he'd stayed when he should have left. The times he'd given her another chance. The times he'd deliberately antagonized her. The times he'd let his children see things they shouldn't see. She wanted to tell him that she knew all the perfect little lies he'd told himself for all those years, because she'd told herself the same lies. She wanted to enfold his trembling hands between her own and say, I understand. She gripped both sides of the lectern and leaned in close to the microphone. There was something so simple and yet so complicated that she needed these people to understand. This can happen. She stopped, stepped away slightly from the microphone, and cleared her throat. She saw Susie standing to one side with the held breath expression of a parent whose child is performing in public for the first time. Her hands were held slightly aloft, as if she were ready to run on stage and scoop Celeste to safety. Celeste put her mouth closer to the microphone, and now her voice was loud and clear. This can happen to anyone.
hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty, read by Caroline Lee. This program was produced and directed by Nicholas Starbuck for Belinda Audio. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Big Little Lies is a production of Penguin Random House Audio, a member of Penguin Group, USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2014. Text copyright 2014 by Leanne Moriarty. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.